a doctor in the house.
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case of loving you.
Doctor.
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 And doctor.
It's time for Advanced Medicine Monday with Dr. Rashid Batar.
I'm a doctor, not a bricklayer.
A doctor, not a mechanic.
I'm a doctor, not a coal miner.
The doctor is in.
All right, y'all, we're ready for hour two on the Robert Scott Bell Show special edition each and every week at this time. It is Advanced Medicine with Dr. Rashid Batar. There is that good-looking guy with a tan. I don't know how he does it, but he's back, and we're going Advanced Medicine. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing very well. That's a 20 minutes a day in the sun. It's important, right? Vitamin D, absorption,
etc. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You're a living example. Get out there and get some good sun. Get kissed by the sun. You're going to benefit from it. Now, I just want to jump back. Like, sometimes I'll throw in something I opened with today, even though it wasn't on your list. There was an article that headline read, physicians aren't burning out. Physicians aren't burning out. They're suffering from moral injury. And I thought, this is a fascinating article. And I think you'll really appreciate it. And I talked about really feeling and having compassion for physicians that go in it for the right reason. And then when they realize that what they were trained is not actually helping people, maybe in an acute sense, we talk about surgical interventions and traumas or that kind of thing. But in a general sense, that what they're doing or trained to do is harmful to people, that there's almost a PTSD, but there's a depression, even a suicide in the profession that's high. And I say, you know, I'm out for doctors too. I want them to have the freedom to do what they went in to do and to not be limited by government agencies that have been captured by the pharmaceutical industrial complex.
Yeah, I think this is a very, very big problem. It's one of the reasons that we've got mass exodus right now in the medical profession. I think we covered a story maybe 6 months ago, Robert, something about where 50% of physicians are either have left the profession or are contemplating leaving the profession. There are doctors that are now doing real estate, doing day trading, becoming pilots, becoming researchers, becoming farmers, which is actually very attractive to me.
I like that too. I love the idea of being in the dirt, you know?
Exactly. And so anyway, I think the reason is because of, as you just mentioned, there are a lot of regulatory oversight type. And I'm not saying that there shouldn't be some regulation. Okay, there should be some regulation, but the regulation should be if doctors are committing a crime. But if a doctor is, what they basically do is, if it's not part and parcel of the modus operandi for the medical hierarchy, they will basically take a doctor that's innovative or a doctor stepping outside of the box and relegate them in the same category as somebody who has, you know, prescribing drugs for like narcotics for profit, or, you know, any one of a number of, because in any group, you're going to end up having people that don't do the right thing, right? So that group, what they've done is they've basically taken a doctor that prescribes vitamin C or a doctor that talks about mineral importance of minerals or chelation or anything like that, and put them in that same category as a doctor that's doing something wrong or something harmful. Of course, because it meets their agenda, right? So in order to meet their agenda, they're going to say, well, we can just take these doctors out, put them in the bad category, because it allows us to now maintain our fiefdom,
yes,
over medicine. And so I think that has a lot to do with doctors not wanting to do what they feel is right, or being scared to do what's right. Or if they do something that's right, they're operating from the shadows, or, you know, they're hiding. But there's a lot of other conventional docs that don't necessarily fall into that category. They're just tired. And the reason for the depression and all that stuff, by the way, the doctors that are doing the right thing, but even though they may not feel confident doing it from the shadows because they're afraid of the repercussions from them doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. If you take those doctors out, they're not suffering from depression, or they're overstimulated and happy because they know in their heart they're doing the right thing and their patients love them. And so they're making a difference, but they're doing it in however fashion they can. Mm-hmm. But the majority of the profession that hasn't stepped out of the box, that's not doing what they feel truly is the right thing, they're the ones who feel the depression and the anxiety and the push to get out of medicine, because they're actually having to operate in conflict on a constant level.
Yes.
On a constant basis, they're in conflict. And just imagine, Robert, if somebody is operating in their life overall, from a constant level of conflict. This is where cancers arise, right? This is where chronic disease arises. This is where sleep imbalances and cardiovascular disease and all sorts of other issues arise. Pathology arises when you are in a state of conflict, when you're in a state of anger, when you feel that people in resentment and frustration. And on a chronic level, it is not good for the body. So yeah. Anyway, I think that's probably the reason. And you know, then there's just the aspect that I don't know why, but there's so many doctors. I think medicine now is like what, the sixth or seventh leading cause of suicide. I know dentistry is one of the highest, but that's because of the mercury.
Right.
And in professional psychiatry, it's pretty high, also suicide rates.
Well, I think that schism in the psyche, again, on a soul level, we know when we do right or when we do wrong, we feel it. But for many, it's unconscious. I grant that. But in the medical profession, if you go in for the right reasons, and I still believe most people do, they end up trapped doing things that they didn't really count on. Now, as I've said in on this show, and I've talked to you about it, my uncle, the doctor, Uncle Bob, told me don't become a doctor because he saw where it was going with government intrusion, red tape, bureaucracy. And he said, you're not going to be happy. He saw that in me. And God bless him for him. It took me a few years to figure that out before I realized why he was saying what he said. But if your bliss is to become a doctor, I won't dissuade you from it. I just want you to go in with your eyes open to recognize what they're going to attempt to do. Put on pharmaceutical horse blinders. They're going to vaccinate you out to yin yang. In fact, the majority of chiropractic schools now require vaccination for entry. So the capture of naturopathic schools as well is, you know, it's the takeover of all of these physician groups. And as you said so well, licensure, it's not that we're against all regulation per se, but how good is the regulation that exists worked? How could a profession like modern medicine become the third leading cause of death and it be protected and endorsed as the only way to go?
You know, it's amazing to me that's happening, Robert. And actually, the professions that have been historically considered to be more aligned with holistic care, like chiropractic and naturopathic medicine, and their deviance now from those principles of holistic medicine going into, as you mentioned, the mandatory vaccinations, also going into the use of antibiotics. I remember you telling me about a lecture that you were at a naturopathic conference and they were talking about the different antibiotics to use for gut,
even prednisone.
Yeah, I mean, in my practice, if any provider prescribes prednisone in any of our clinics, the California clinic, that is grounds for dismissal.
Yes.
Steroids and antidepressants, you know, and actually statin drugs too. That's actually statin drugs and steroids are the two that I will let them go for. But also the use of statin drugs and antidepressants and steroids. Those are the three categories that are really, really bad. And they're really bad. I'm not saying just really bad from a philosophical standpoint. They're really bad to what they do to the body physiologically, right? Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting to me, I just had actually maybe a month and a half ago, a friend of mine that's a naturopathic physician. She's a junior physician. And in the clinic that they're working at, she was told that she was basically mandated to give vaccines and she refused. And I was surprised when she told me this, but she said that she was told to do this by a senior naturopathic physician that was in the clinic. So that was the attending physician. And I said, wait a second, what? And she said, basically, they're required to do it. And the senior naturopathic physician, who's it's a pediatric, they have the subspecialties similar to allopathic and osteopathic medicine, where they have the different specialties. And he's apparently a pediatrician. And he apparently may not have wanted to do it. So he was mandating, because of the mandate for the clinic was that to give the vaccines, mandated a junior physician to do it. And she basically refused. She stood her ground and she refused, which, you know, very few people have the tenacity and the courage and the confidence to hold their ground and say, no, I'm not going to do it. Because she could have, you know, be reprimanded. She could be written up. She could whatever. But she stood her ground. And I told her that's exactly what she should have done. And I was proud of her for doing it. But it's not right for people that are junior physicians or students to have to be put in a situation where they're mandated to do something that is against their own philosophy, against their own belief system, against their own very innate nature. That's wrong. Because now we're, you know, that learning center or that learning facility is now forcing them into conflict. And healing is not about conflict.
Well, and we think about the conflict of piercing the skin and injecting toxic poisons, even antigens, which is the key to the vaccine paradigm from their perspective, is that they cut the skin or violate the, you know, 1,000,000,000 layers of immunity and go directly into the blood tissue or the vascular system or the muscular system. And not only that, it's now not just one antigen. They're really, and you've probably seen this too, they're worried if people aren't as compliant. They don't want to come in for as many shots. So how many antigens can we throw in one shot? And here's an article today. I'm gonna show everybody this that's watching on YouTube. You can see this. The combination vaccines and febrile seizures. Should parents be concerned? And of course, it can happen with a single antigen vaccine. But now they're talking about massive hexagonal, what they call it, a hexavalent combination vaccine manufactured in partnership with Sanofi Pasteur and Merck for children between the ages of 6 weeks and 4 years of age, which will include diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, hepatitis B, polio, and Haemophilus influenza type B. And it will still require the additional DTaP after that series. I mean, there's so many things that are wrong with this, but even one antigen along with the other garbage that they pierce the skin with, again, this is not how the immune system works. This is not how we interact with the world normally. And so, Dr. Bitar, this is, again, febrile seizures is something I want you to certainly to comment on. But one, six, I mean, how many antigens is too many to inject into innocent children?
Well, I think the point that you just made is such an important point. Just think about it. This is not how we interact with our environment naturally. We are not hit with six pathogens at any given time. We don't get hit with six different types of diseases, infectious diseases, at any given time. That's one. Secondly, we never get hit with any disease with an immunosuppressive on board, you know? So to say that, okay, wait a second, you know, okay, one disease, maybe two, and, you know, if you're like a lottery winner or something, but then to get hit with immunosuppressives, and not just one immunosuppressive, but multiple immunosuppressives, like mercury and formaldehyde, nickel, and blah, blah, blah. Then on top of that, we get introduced additional antigens and additional haptens, additional foreign substances, additional adjuvants that are designed to stimulate the immune system. Anything designed to stimulate the immune system, just so everybody knows, it's designed to stimulate the immune system to theoretically mount a greater immune response. But the problem is, it's the same thing as a pathogen. An adjuvant is the same thing as a pathogen. It's not a pathogen, but it's acting to elicit the same response in the body that the pathogen would. So when you get an adjuvant, the idea is it's going to irritate the immune system, okay? Just like a pathogen would. So it's called the antigen-antibody reaction or antigen-hapten reaction. In this case, we don't have an antibody, so they're just introducing that into the body to help agitate it. So now you're throwing all these. You've got the infectious component, which is an attenuated virus or, you know, a dead virus or whatever. Then you've got adjuvants, which are additional burden. Then you've got immunosuppressives. And to add insult to injury, as if that's not bad enough, you do it at a point in the body when the immune system isn't even developed enough yet to perform a response because it's too immature. It doesn't even start developing till 6 months into a year. And depending on which immunologist's research you read or which philosophy you read, it could take anywhere from 3 to 15 years. I mean, some people say that the immune system isn't fully mature till an individual is 13, 14, 15 years of age. So if this is, I mean, certainly the immune system starts to develop within a year, within that 1 year. But if you're going to give vaccinations, if you're going to do it, take out the adjuvant, give it single dose vials with one pathogen at a time, space it out, you know, a month or two apart, and give it after the immune system is actually developed, i.e. 2 years of age, and then stop putting things that are suppressive to the immune system. How do you expect, it's like saying, okay, I got to start a fire, but mm-hmm. let me just, you know, hose it down with water constantly. It doesn't make any sense. So basically what they're saying is, let me start the fire, i.e. let me get this immune response going, but let me water it down constantly, which is, let me give immunosuppressives to reduce the effect of the immune system, so the immune system can't work. It's absolute insanity.
Dr. Bitar, let me ask you real quick about, because I agree with you, obviously, but
I would have kept on going. So I know. I'm glad you stopped me.
Most of the way we interact with what they call pathogens, even though we might, from a terrain concept, say, you know, it isn't so much what you catch, it's what's already there that becomes opportunistic. But isn't it true that most of that will interact first with our mucous membranes? If it's not the skin, then in our mouth or throat or sinus cavity, or if you can even get down into the throat or the trachea even. But there's nothing about the vaccine introduction via piercing the skin and injecting it that honors and acknowledges the way the immune system interacts with the world. So already they've jumped the shark, so to speak. They're just like paying no attention to how the body works. Let's just do it this way.
So for people that don't watch the show and that are new watching the show, this is like Robert, you know, he's like a basketball player and I'm like a basketball player. And he just throws the balls up there with a perfect alley-oop to allow me to slam it through the hoop. You know, so when he asks these questions, he actually knows the answer himself very well. And this is exactly the case, because you've got the secretory immunoglobulins, right? You've got the IgA, IgE, IgM, IgD, and Ig. Which one did I miss? Ig. I forgot one from IgE, A, G, M, and S. Right. So those are the five immunoglobulins. So, for example, when you were mentioning about the secretory immunoglobulin, when you were talking about the mucous members, that is IgS, the secretory immunoglobulins. That's the immunoglobulin that then recognizes whatever is foreign and mounts an immune response. IgM is the maternal immunoglobulin. That's the one that moms create so that when the baby's born, now that those immunoglobulins either pass through the placenta or through the breast milk. Okay, IgE, for example, IgE immunoglobulin. There you go.
I'm just spraying something in my mucous membranes because I've been terrain hit from the stress of last week's broadcast through this new technology, and I got hammered this weekend. So like I'm strategizing, what do I do to help my immune system respond? It isn't, oh, let me go out and get a shot or let me get an antibiotic. It's about how do we enhance it.
Exactly. So IgE immunoglobulin is the one that's responsible for the anaphylactic type reactions when you get a bee sting or, you know, if you have a acute sensitivity to, say, iodine or strawberries or some fish, I mean, or something like that, and you have that acute anaphylactic reaction, that's an IgE-mediated reaction. Mm-hmm. The delayed food allergies are actually IgG-mediated reactions. So anyway, mm-hmm. Each different type of immunoglobulin is responsible for a different type of immune response. And so there is no immune response that is associated with an injection going in. Now, a puncture wound or a penetrating wound, some people would say, well, that's breaking the skin and entering. Yes, it is. But the primary method, and I don't know whether it would be IgE response or maybe it's a general response. It's probably an IgA, IgG, and IgE response. But regardless, we don't get inoculated with infectious diseases directly through penetration of the skin.
Right.
If you do get something, it's usually a secondary infection based upon something penetrating through the skin and then carrying the natural bacteria, the staph and the strep bacteria that's on the skin, that when it penetrates the skin, whatever the injury is that's penetrating the skin, will allow the natural bacteria that's on our skin to go into the skin and then cause a soft tissue infection that causes cellulitis or something like that.
But in nature, that basically is telling us, if we follow nature, unfortunately the vaccine community doesn't, they try to violate it, is that that's not a good thing. It really challenges the body extraordinarily. And I say extraordinary. It's not a typical way we would interact with the world. It's an accident. It's an unusual event. And the insight from that would be, you know, we don't want to do that. We don't want to do that on purpose. That's not a good thing. And yet they don't seem to see it.
It's actually more than that, Robert. We wouldn't want to do that because it's not natural. I totally get that. And I agree with you. We don't want to do that for that reason. But there's another bigger reason, because the system isn't designed to function that way. And if we try, it's like trying to take a race car and putting it in a field to try to plow a field, okay? Or maybe it's like trying to take a race car and trying to use it as a submarine in water. It's not going to work. And so when you're violating the way that the system was designed, you're not going to get the same kind of response. And it's so absurd. It's almost like that they went out there and found a fisherman or no insult to fishermen or you know, like somebody who deals with construction, or no insult to anybody who's in construction. Actually, that even a fisherman and a construction person would understand, wait a second, this doesn't make sense. You know, what you're going to do with the vaccine. And
right.
The people that created this, I don't care what profession anybody's in, it would violate the, once they understand, you know, you're given a 1 hour lecture, they would say, well, this doesn't make any sense. But with the 1 hour lecture, anybody from 5 years to any, regardless of profession, regardless, would understand that we are violating the very premise of how the body works. So to me, the way that they're doing this and how they're orchestrating this, there is something else nefarious about this. There's an agenda that we don't know about, which I think is
because it's not like this information is not known. It's not available. It Absolutely is. Now, the question is other aspects of danger here. Now, we've talked about the autism spectrum, the mercury relationship, and all the things that contribute. There's even arguments now in the literature about pesticide exposure in utero during the pregnancy that is resulting in a higher incidence or risk for autism. We can get into that. But to just quickly to go back to this article, because I think it's fascinating about the febrile seizures. This the authors of this study said, well, of course, they always say the risk is small, but the incidence of seizures increased as much as sixfold with these five-valent vaccines. In other words, more antigens, more febrile seizures. Now, the problem with febrile seizures are what? I mean, it's not that fever itself is the problem, but when it triggers seizures, there's something else going metabolically awry within the cells or the nervous system, or something's happening. Maybe you can reveal a little bit more about that, Dr. Bitar.
Well, when you're dealing with a febrile seizure, you want to talk about the seizures or the febrile component?
Yeah, I mean, that's what this article is about, how these multi-antigen vaccines, I know, again, it can happen with a single antigen, but they're saying, hey, the risk is even greater. And differentiate between a fever response than a fever that is also accompanied by a seizure or a febrile seizure.
Right. So a fever response is considered to be relatively normal after giving a vaccine. And I don't understand why eliciting a fever would be considered normal. But the theory is, well, you're giving a foreign substance to create an antibody response. So the body's going through like a mini reaction, a mini infectious process, that when the, God forbid, the real disease hits or the real infectious process hits, the body's now been entrained. That's the whole premise behind a vaccine. So the body's now entrained to respond. So you've got the antibodies there ready to go. The body doesn't have to develop them. They're ready to respond at a moment's notice. Okay, that's the theory. Now, the problem is that usually this is not a controlled component, right? So different people will respond differently. And when the seizure takes place, that is pathognomonic for having crossed the line, meaning that a seizure is not a normal component. And when a person ends up having a febrile seizure, which, you know, in medicine they talk about, it's considered almost like, oh, it's okay, it's part of the, you know, vaccine. I mean, I don't think anybody says that's normal, but their attitude is very avant-garde. You know, well, you know, it happens.
Nonchalant even, but I mean, and then the risk, of course, with the prolonged fevers leading to epilepsy, right? Seizure disorders that follow on to this thing. So I don't mean to downplay that the febrile or the heat. I think all of these things are important to know, but the more antigens they throw in it, obviously the more complicated it gets for an immune response and the more devastating it can be, I believe.
Well, absolutely. But it's actually the causation, right? So you're causing enough of a neurochemistry shift, a change, that the body responds in a manner that it's not a natural response, because we're giving an unnatural exposure and the body responds in an unnatural manner. But when you start having brain seizure, when you basically have seizures, you're having abnormal brain activity, which means that it's affecting the system so dramatically that it's causing a shift in the physiology and the brain chemistry. Okay, if that's happening to the brain, can you imagine what's happening to the rest of the body? Because the liver, the kidneys, the gut, they're not able to handle the load, and it's now affecting the brain, it's affecting the heart, it's affecting all sorts of things. So when somebody has a seizure, the medical community will just treat it with the fever aspect and then say, okay, now let's watch it. And then they'll consider starting to use seizure, anti-seizure medication. By the way, Robert's going to buy lunch for anybody that can answer this question correctly. So if you're listening to us on Facebook, go ahead and post this, post the answer to this. If you're on Instagram, post the answer. If you're on YouTube, post the answer. Super Don can monitor that. But can anybody tell me, and it has to be within the next 30 seconds or next 1 minute. We'll give you 1 minute to answer this question. Mm-hmm. Well, next 30 seconds, because I'll give you too much time to Google it. And I don't want Robert to have to buy lunch for 5,000 people. But, 100 people is enough. So what is the number one side effect of anti-seizure medication? Mm-hmm. 30 seconds. Dude. All right, so we can continue. But, you know, this is one of the things that it's preposterous that people think that a acute neurological shift causing a seizure should only be put aside as, okay, well, you know, you had the vaccines and it's a fever and okay, let's just watch it. And if it happens again, we'll just put you in anti-seizure medication. And now the diagnosis diagnosed as having a seizure disorder or their epilepsy or whatever it is. And they categorize the different types of seizures and act as if this person has this issue where it's completely iatrogenic. It's completely caused by the population.
Let me ask you this. In your decades as a physician, how many of your patients died of a common cold, or other physicians that you know have reported to you, Dr. Batara, you won't believe this, I had somebody die of the common cold?
Yeah, I can imagine that. Robert, let's hold up for a second, because I'm telling you right now, we've had so many people. You owe lunch to a lot of people.
I know. You volunteered me. I didn't agree to this.
We've got the Remedy Chef and Trish Gilbert and Al Soto and Teresa McManus and Melissa Smith and Lisa Smith and Amy Jordan.
Hold on.
And Maureen Mackey.
Enough already.
And Lynn Campbell and Andrea. Okay, so you have about a dozen people to go lunch to at the Advanced Medicine Conference.
In Pasadena. All right. Let me check in with Super Don and see if anybody on our YouTube channel got this right, because the answer is seizures. Super Don, anybody on our channel get it right? Do we have any smart folks out there watching out?
Kimberly got it. Ula got it. Steve got it. Suzanne got it. Christina got it.
Patty, sorry. I see Patty got it.
Yeah.
No, Patty said liver failure. Okay. Well, that's an adjunct, but that wasn't the right answer as far as what we were looking for at that moment.
You got saved there, because you don't have to get Patty lunch then. There's a couple of different people that actually use some other answers, depression and some other things, but the right immune system suppression and, you know, all the answer is seizures. The anti-seizure medication side effect, number one side effect, is more seizures. So does it make any sense? It's like saying, yeah, the stuff that I'm used to, the stuff that I've been told to
class,
the fire,
right?
The side effect is causing more fires.
Right.
It doesn't make any sense. And for those of you that obviously know these answers, I'm going to actually join you guys for lunch to make sure Robert pays, but I'll probably pay for my own lunch. But anyway, that's the medicine conference.
I won't have bus money to get home. Yeah.
I'm gonna write these names down. I don't want everybody to come up and say, oh yeah, I got the answer right. So we're gonna write these names down. Super Don, make a list of it so we make sure that these people are taken out to lunch.
I don't recall agreeing to this before we went on the air there, Dr. Batara. All right, well, we're going to have fun, though. I want everybody to come see us at the Advanced Medicine Conference, May 25th, 26th, that Saturday, Sunday of Memorial Day weekend in Pasadena, California, Los Angeles area. It's going to be outrageously, it's going to be great. It's going to be so great. And Dr. Bruce Lipton, I could sit and listen to the entire weekend, and he's going to be doing some presentations there as well. That's worth the price of admission. Forget Dr. B and me, RSB. But no, there are going to be some great stuff happening there. So I hope you'll sign up at robertscottbell.com. We still have some discount tickets, including VIP tickets available for you. Also, we are speaking of seizures, cannabidiol CBD from hemp has the ability to reduce some seizure activity. Of course, the FDA has now approved Epidiolex as a high concentration. Fortunately, it's not a synthetic, but it is a high concentration isolate for untreatable or intractable seizure disorders in children. But we can do it with the dietary supplement form. We're going to be giving away a 2-ounce bottle to some of our listeners, at least one. And in order to find out how to enter, you got to go to robertscottbell.com and sign up for email alerts. That's easy. And you'll be instructed by Super Don how to enter. We're not going to tell you how to enter. You got to sign up and we'll blast out an email to you. And you might be a winner of some CBD. How about that? Giving away. Now we can give away stuff. Now that I'm buying everybody lunch.
Yeah, there you go. I think you buying lunch is a much bigger deal than the CBD, I'll tell you that. So, and guys, we'll make sure that we pick, you know, like a really, really nice, fancy restaurant, you know, not like McDonald's, but more like Taco Bell type thing. No.
Okay, how about some Chipotle, maybe? I'm too conscious of that. Listen, let's take a break and a breather. When we come back, of course, I talked about the Dirty Dozen list, now includes kale. These pesticides, another of the persistent organic pollutants that Dr. Batara talks about in his book, 9 Steps to Keep the Doctor Away, and we certainly lecture on them as well. Just going to take a breather. We'll get set up to do more of advanced medicine here on the Robert Scott Bell Show. Remember, links are up to advancedmedicine.com. We're going to tell you how you can participate in upcoming webinars and be part of the organization that takes you out of the public domain so we can speak even more directly to you. In a way that we don't have to hold back at all. So that's going to be fun, too. So stand by for that information, and we'll be back in just a little bit. All right, back at it here on the Robert Scott Bell Show. Dr. Rasha Batara rocking the health world for, well, I don't know. How about some health freedom? How about some healing liberty? You want some of that? I can't get enough of it. And it's great when Dr. Batara and I get together because it ramps it up even further. If that's possible, I think somehow we do it.
I think we do.
Yes. So I asked you this question. It was sort of tongue in cheek, but there was an article about they want to come up with, they're actually working feverishly, speaking of fever, on a vaccine for the common cold. I'm like, really? Really? This is not, where does this rank on cause of death in America?
Yeah, you know, it's, again, if the agenda is to dumb down the population and make them weaker, make their immune systems weaker, make them more susceptible, make them more dependent, then it makes sense to create a vaccine for a common cold. It makes sense to make a vaccine against pushing a shopping cart. It makes sense to make a vaccine for going out and breathing air just in case there's a pollutant out there that you might inhale. Or so it makes sense to, if you're trying to control the population and limit the population and control rate of population growth, it makes sense to do that. But if it's really to promote health, there's no place for that. The common cold plays a normal role in helping our immune systems develop. Just think about this. Common cold where nobody ever dies, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even the flu, okay, for people, when they say people die of the flu, what do people really die of when they die of the flu, Robert? Tell me.
It's secondary and tertiary complications from the process of battling back an acute viral, massive explosion. You know, it's the lung issues, it's the bacterial infections, pneumonia. These are the things that people are really dying of. They might succeed in beating back the virus, but they're excretory organs. We talked about this: liver congestion, kidney congestion, lymph. They're dehydrated. And the Tylenol that the doctors are giving these patients.
Robert went a lot deeper than I expected him to. But here's the thing: it really comes down to what you just said. It's complications. That's really what it is. The liver congestion and the kidney and all that stuff. That's usually because they've already got an impaired issue because their kidneys and liver aren't working. It's not caused necessarily by the virus, but the virus can be an overload.
Right.
But it's the dehydration. Okay. Most people, it's a dehydration component because they just get fluid depleted. They get diarrhea. So again, the body's trying to get rid of the stuff and they start throwing up because the body's trying to get rid of whatever the foreign substance is. So they get minerally depleted. And then on top of that, to add insult to injury, you've now got doctors giving them medication to keep them from throwing up, to keep them from having diarrhea. So they're keeping whatever the body's trying to get rid of inside the body. And on top of that, now giving Tylenol that's causing further liver issues. Non-steroidals so their bodies aren't sore, which is causing more impact on the kidneys. That's what people die from the flu from. The flu typically is a self-limiting issue, okay? But when they talk about these flu endemics that cause all these mass deaths, well, first of all, these were, 50, 75 years ago when they didn't have sufficient resources to be able to put IVs in everybody and just rehydrate them. If you can rehydrate a person, just rehydrate them. You've already probably decreased the mortality rate by 90% just by rehydrating a person.
Yes.
That has the flu. It's that simple.
But am I exaggerating though about their penchant for putting Tylenol in these people to reduce the severity of their pain? I mean, that's not going to be a good thing.
Liver. Okay. Cause of the number one cause in the United States for toxicity. Yes, liver failure. But I'm saying the number one overdose issue in the United States is from in emergency rooms, as far as people coming in, is from Tylenol.
Acetaminophen, right?
Yes, that's right. Acetaminophen.
Don't they call it Panadol elsewhere? I've heard that term, Panadol.
Yeah, Panadol is
paracetamol.
Paracetamol, yes.
Paracetamol, right.
Yeah.
There's many different names for it, but basically it's acetaminophen. That's the generic component, right? And then they'll have some of the narcotics that are put in together with the Tylenol, if it's aspirin versus Tylenol. But the point is, yes, it will bring the fever down, but what it does to the liver is absolutely devastating. And it's not that they give you a little bit. The Tylenol is given every 4 hours, okay? And it's given over around the clock. So if somebody has a fever, you're supposed to give it every 4 hours. And basically, I'll tell you the truth. I've used Tylenol myself. I used to prescribe it all the time myself because I didn't know any better. But since then, there's so many other things that people can use for helping to break the fever. Yes. I'll just tell you, I don't even really deal with the fever issue now because fever is a body's natural response to an acute infection. That is the body's natural response. We shouldn't be suppressing it. Now, if it gets over 104 degrees, 105 degrees, now you're starting to get in that borderline where you're going to cause protein denaturing. So in that case, I would probably use something. But there are so many things. Robert, give us like three or four things that people can use
Well, just
natural.
Yeah, just from the homeopathic Materia Medica, the things I've used clinically, phosphorus, homeopathic phosphorus for any adult with a systemic fever. And the thing is, it will boost a fever that needs boosting. It will reduce a fever that needs reducing. So you're working with the body to help the body do what it's supposed to do. If it's a dangerously high fever, it'll come down. For kids, of course, the classic one is Belladonna. You can use a derivation of phosphorus, ferrum phosphoricum, ferrum phos. So there are a number of remedies in the homeopathic kingdom, so to speak, that we can use without, and none of this results in liver toxicity, dehydration, any of the things that end up with the complications.
And that's just homeopathically, right? Yeah. There's many other things that can be done. If you just rehydrate, you know, if a patient comes into the emergency room, I'm going to just give them fluids, and the fluids are going to help bring their fever down. Exactly. In fact, we don't give warm fluid; we just give regular room temperature fluids, and that'll bring the temperature down. But there's many things that can be done. Now, some people say, "Well, what about the inflammation?" Well, things for inflammation. I know plastic surgeons now. I know general surgeons now. That was what my training was before I left surgery, was in general surgery and trauma surgery. But I know surgeons that will use arnica before and after surgery to reduce inflammation, right? Mm-hmm. So, and besides arnica, what else is there, Robert, that we can use for anti-inflammatory, natural anti-inflammatory?
Well, the CBD has shown evidence of reduction, so the cannabinoids can be helpful here. Of course, reduction of pain. Anytime you have inflammation, you have pain of the nerves too. So hypericum perforatum, which is St. John's wort, and there are complex formulations that include a lot of other things. So there's a number of things that we can use. And if you're into the NSAID concept, herbally, you can use the origin point in the plant kingdom, like the white willow barks of the world. And you know, of course, they always say, well, it could have a dangerous drug interaction. Well, really, I'm more concerned about the drug than the herb when you use it and know how to use it properly.
Right, right. It's something, you know, in the 9 Steps to Keep the Doctor Away, in the book, that you can see behind me on my
right shoulder.
Behind my right shoulder. Okay, thanks. I couldn't tell which way it was on my side. But anyway, I talk about how does one know if, like from a dietary standpoint, a nutrition standpoint, how does one know whether they should eat it or not? So I have this very, very elaborate methodology. And this elaborate, detailed methodology is, if God made it, God starts with G, God is good. So when God made it, it's good. If man made it, man is madness. Man made is madness. It's that simple. Look at it. If you don't know, just ask yourself, is this naturally derived? Is God made it or did man make it? If man made it, stay the hell away from it. If God made it, it's probably
embrace it. Now, speaking of man-made versus God-made, of course, food, it's on this planet, God-made, but we can grow it. But the question is, how do we grow it? Pesticides. This is not something self-limiting. It's persistent in the environment. Even the clean organic foods are not as clean as they once were. And now we have an article here that, you know, confirms, again, something that you know all so well, relations or threats to the risk of developing neurological issues like autism even. Here's a story about a mother's exposure to pesticides during pregnancy may raise children's autism risk. Now, we're not saying that the pesticides are made of mercury, because we know mercury is the primary culprit here, but the degeneration over time of the body's ability to excrete anything and everything is going to be hampered by constant or persistent organic pollutants. Am I in the ballpark there, Dr. Bitar?
Absolutely. You're right in the ballpark. You're right in home base and first base and second base and third base and hitting the home plate. The reason we call them persistent organic pollutants is because they persist in the body and they can't come out. And, you know, you mentioned, I don't think you just mentioned the Dirty Dozen just now, but you did mention it right before we went to break, that you were talking about the Dirty Dozen. And the Dirty Dozen, for those of you that don't know what the Dirty Dozen is, I actually wrote about this. I actually had a part of my cancer presentation as far back, I think at A4M, which was in 2001, 2002 was the first time I showed that slide. But the Dirty Dozen are the 12 chemicals. I can't remember all of them right now, but like DDT was one of those, and there's a bunch of different ones. And the Dirty Dozen were used in industry rampantly all over the planet for years. I think the least used of the chemicals in Dirty Dozen was used for 45 years before they decided that it was one of the Dirty Dozen. I think that was at a conference in South Africa in the late 80s, early 90s. That they had this meeting and they decided these chemicals had too much destructive, too many destructive components to them, had caused too many deaths. And so they categorize them as a dirty dozen. And basically, the vast majority of the world's nations banned them or outlawed them so that they would not be used in industry anymore. But what really intrigues me that is that it took 45 years for the lease run. Some of them were used for you know, 50, 60 years. So the fastest that they identified one of these as being one of the dirty dozen, took them 45 years before they said, oh, maybe we shouldn't be using this poison, right? Some of these were used for 60 years or plus. So these dirty dozen are no longer allowed to be used. But there's so many other chemicals, persistent organic pollutants. There's over 100,000 chemicals that are introduced annually. These are synthetic things, new derivatives annually that are introduced. Of course, most of them don't get to see the light of day, but a lot of them, maybe 1,000 or more, are introduced into global society, into commerce on an annual basis. What are the implications on the physiological system? I didn't even say the human physiological system. I'm talking about physiology, whether it's an animal, plant. Right. It doesn't make any difference because it's a cycle of life, right? Cycle of life. We eat plants. We eat animals. So even if we're not being exposed to it directly, we're being exposed to it indirectly. So it's a massive, massive problem. And we're changing. In fact, this falls into the category of the sixth toxicity in my seven toxicity philosophy, right? Well, it's foods.
Food. Well, real quick, I need to intervene here because in the Time Magazine article about this, it's very disempowering because they say the problem is that unlike the behavior such as smoking or drinking alcohol, exposure to pesticides is usually not in people's control, she says. And pregnant women often aren't aware that they're exposed to the chemicals. But I mean, we have some level of control to reduce some level of exposure. And they don't even mention that, hey, why not try eating organic non-GMO foods to reduce your exposure? Why not grow your own food? Again, these are messages that I think, why wouldn't they put that in there? That seems like a simple thing. I mean, people say, well, it's not realistic. Well, is it more realistic to just put your head in the pesticide-laden sand?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very, very disturbing thing because it's disempowering. That information is disempowering. But what I was going to say was that in my seven toxicities, when I talk about the sixth toxicity, it's foods, but it's not what we're eating, it's what we do to the foods, right?
Right.
It's the homogenization, the pasteurization, the irradiation, the genetic modification, and then all the different substances that are used during the processing of that food and during the harvest of the food, the growing of that food. This is where the insecticides and the pesticides and all these things come out. One of the posts that I saw recently that really, really was impressive, Robert, I just saw it come through on Instagram. Mm-hmm. It was really interesting to see a guy by the name of Collective Spark, I think that's the pseudonym, put out. And it was an image of a fruit tree with somebody reaching out to pick a fruit. I think it looked like a pear.
Mm-hmm.
And the caption was, in public parks and public places, instead of planting regular trees, we should plant fruit trees and allow people to just go and pick the fruit and eat them anyway. Just think about that from a hunger standpoint. How many people in all the big cities are homeless that are always begging for food, right? Whether you're talking about third world countries or the big nations of the world. Just imagine if New York City had fruit trees, like apple trees, pear trees, peach trees, or Chicago, or anywhere, you know, any of the cities in the United States, any of the cities in Europe, any of the cities in South America, in North America, in Europe, in Asia, in Africa. If they planted trees in all public arenas that bear fruit. We plant trees everywhere, but they're usually ornamental trees. Why not plant fruit trees? I mean, I thought that was such a brilliant idea because now everybody has free fruit. Of course, the fruit manufacturers wouldn't like that, and they would probably,
maybe not.
You know,
but I think that, you know, this is one of the things I've talked about, heroes, right? And we could talk about all these gallant efforts to do these amazing things. I think one of the most amazing things anybody can do is just what you said, plant things that people can eat. Right. I'd like to see all of these things. We had a great place back in Central Florida, a guy from France who came over to Florida to start not an ornamental tree kind of place, but a nursery for only food bearing trees, avocados, mangoes. I mean, all the things that would grow there. But that's the kind of innovation that could bring, again, the power to eat back to the people. Growing these things seasonally, even, or if you're in a northern climate, to have them now, you can grow them even in their own containers. You could take them in the winter and still keep them going. So there's a lot of options out there that don't rely upon government delivery or multinational corporation delivery. To grow your own food is one of the most, what do they call it? some kind of act. Maybe Superdon can remember it. It's like a not a violent act, but it's like the act of disobedience. I don't know what it is, to grow your own food. One of the most threatening things to the power structures on planet Earth.
Civil disobedience?
Maybe that's a form of civil disobedience. But it's a good and empowering thing to do and teach others to do. I'm getting ready to dive into the garden here, even though we've got, they say, freezes up for another month potentially. But I think I can grow some of the, like the onions, the things that I'm going to start planting now to get ready for the garden this summer. I'm very excited about that.
And sometimes people will say, well, you know, I live in the city, I don't have a garden. Well, you've got technology like hydroponics, and they will allow you to grow things on, you know, roofs of skyscrapers and stuff. And I've seen pictures of that. And I'll tell you, there is something uniquely different, energetically, spiritually. I don't know what it is, but there is something different when you eat a piece of fruit or vegetable that you've grown yourself. I could have never imagined it. If somebody had told me 5 years ago, 10 years ago, you know, grow your own food, and we talked about it, you know, I used to think about it, but I had, you know, an employee that would, you know, take care of the farm. You know, I remember having my own A2 cows when I had the farm. But I find myself spending time in my orchard. It's the weirdest thing, because I am not a person that likes to, you know, I mean, I'm going, there's so many different things, you know, why would I want to spend time in the orchard? But getting your hands in dirt, that's one thing. But watching the trees grow and being able to pull a little piece of fruit off and eat, tasting it. I don't know, Robert, maybe it's in my head, but it tastes better.
It's where God is. Honestly, you get into that, you follow the rhythm of life, the vitality, you feel it, you're connected to it. I mean, there's a reason for this place we live. It's created. It's not an artificial accident. And all of these things we're trying to do to artificialize it are disconnecting us or removing us from the source of all sources. So I think I feel it too when I'm out there doing it. And I never grew up doing that either. So for me,
I just want to say what Robert just said. He said, this is where God is. Okay. If you guys didn't hear that, I want to bring attention to that again. This is where God is. And when Robert said that, I felt the cold shivers, because it's the truth. When the truth resonates with us, we can feel it, right? Mm-hmm. And that is the truth. I remember when I was a little kid, my dad told me that, you know, we were talking about God, what God looked like. And my dad said he sees God all the time. And long story short, basically, he took us to a place with a field with lots of flowers. And then we had to sit there and quiet, wait for God. My brother and I were sitting there waiting. It ended up being a butterfly landing on a flower. And my dad said, there. And we're like, what? And it was a butterfly landing in the flower. And my brother was like, what do you mean? That's not God. That's a butterfly. But that's where God is. Now, you know, you're talking about, metaphorically speaking, that's where God is when you see the butterfly land and the flower and the pollination. But when you want to experience it, eat a piece of fruit that you've grown or a vegetable you've grown. And that is where God is. That's beautiful, because that's exactly what I don't even know why I'm being drawn to it. But I go to the orchard and you know, we work in the orchard, and we experience the difference. I mean, we literally experience the difference.
Yeah.
So one of the great things you can do with your kids, you know, you may have to beat them to get them to do this point, because I feel I'm going to drag Rohan out to have him experience this. But, you know, the one or two times he came out, he didn't do much with the orchard. He was just helping me move some dirt around and stuff.
Right.
But while we were there working on the orchard, he was in there. And I can tell you, if you can drag your kid out there and have them start to do something, they will start experiencing it, because kids are more connected anyway than we are as adults. So get them. Process.
And there's one more article we won't have time to hit. Unless you can stick around, we can go extra innings together after the show, right? But the concept of ADHD, ADHD drugs, etc., a new study showing that this can lead to psychosis of all things. And we'll talk about that. But to your point, if the kids are reluctant initially, and they are, you know, kids are like, oh, do I have to? They get out there and then they find God there in their own way. And they like, can I get back out in that garden and play in the dirt? I'm telling you, these kids, rarely have I don't think I've ever found a kid that didn't ultimately say, that is awesome. I love it. So if we can talk.
Think about this. So little kids always go and play in the dirt anyway. You can't get money in dirt.
We can learn a lot from little kids. Listen, we can learn a lot from Dr. Bitar. That's why we have Advanced Medicine each and every week. Links are up in the show notes at robertscottbell.com. Remember to sign up for email alerts there to get the possibility of winning some CBD as well. And we'll see you at Advanced Medicine Conference on Memorial Day weekend. And even before that, next week's Advanced Medicine as well. We'll be right back for those of you sticking around for bonus time with Dr. Bitar, myself, and Super Don. Thanks for being here. Tell them what they need to know real quick, Dr. Bitar.
The power to heal is yours.
The Robert Scott Bell Show.